From 7CTOs, my name is Etienne De Bruin, and you're listening to the CTO Podcast. Every week, I spend time with fascinating people that enrich the lives of chief technology officers around the world. From perfecting the basics of building technology organizations to inspiring our minds into shaping our future. As always, the CTO Podcast is brought to you by 7CTOs, helping CTOs become world-class leaders. Let's go. This week, we have the Director of Technology at Fuse Integration, Dell Kronenwitter. We talk about a lot of things around RF communication. He gives us a little primer on encryption and how that works with red and black and Bob and Alice and Eve. And we talk a little bit about satellite communications and AI in a hybrid, highly regulated environment. So enjoy. Kronenwitter, welcome to the CTO Podcast.
Glad to be here, Adrian.
That whiteboard is impressive.
I get a lot of compliments on my whiteboard. It changes a lot, so that's the important.
Okay, I was about to ask if it's one of those situations where it becomes a thing and then you don't want to touch it.
Nope, it's always changing. That's the best part.
I love it. No state secrets or company secrets on there?
Nope, just day-to-day engineering discussions and lots of ideas and that sort of stuff.
I love it. I think most CTOs are whiteboarders. Are you in a situation where you can't actually explain anything without going to your whiteboard?
Yeah, I typically need a whiteboard. That's why it's a little challenging. I was thinking about something that I want to talk about today, which is this encryption stuff. And I was trying to think about how can I do it without a whiteboard? And it's going to be a little challenging, but I got an idea.
Well, you know, on that point, which is I find that sometimes the whiteboard is a bit of a crutch for me when I want to explain stuff. And I'll tell you what I mean by that. I have found that you get so in the habit of needing to draw what you're trying to say that I think sometimes I lose my audience because they're like, dude, all I asked you was if we should use a password manager. And then I go, well, let me explain to you on the whiteboard. And then I draw this big thing and I take a simple question and I turn it into a multifaceted diagram.
But you've got so much to say, right? So you know what I do is I have my portable whiteboard right here. and so it's really hard to see that whiteboard. Sometimes I'll like pick up my camera and pull it over to the whiteboard, but I just pull my portable whiteboard here and hold it in front. I know people have these fancy tools that let you do like online diagramming and stuff like that, but I just take this whiteboard, hold it right up to the screen. And
so when you're on a Zoom call, you'll pull up that portable whiteboard and you'll start drawing what you're saying.
Exactly.
Fascinating.
Yes. I seem to be the only one. I don't meet a lot of other people that do this technique, but I found it works for me. I don't know.
I mean, it's certainly, for those who are listening and not seeing what I'm seeing, it's busy.
Yeah, what's unfortunate is you can probably find about three of the same drawing on here because somebody else will come in the room and talk, and then I'll just start drawing somewhere and not realize that it's somewhere else. My picture's somewhere else. But the sequence of events is important too. You want it when you're describing stuff on the whiteboard. You got to draw this comes first and that comes first. So
that is the big advantage of the whiteboard technique is to you can sort of guide someone into the grand finale.
Yeah.
Have you tried to explain stuff without a whiteboard?
Yeah, I mean, I have to sometimes, but usually there's whiteboards everywhere. Yeah. Our CEO is really into whiteboards, so
that's cool.
He just populates the whole company with whiteboards wherever you go, so it's really helpful.
That's very helpful. So, speaking of which, you are the top technical person at Fuse.
Director of Technology.
Director of Technology, encompassing all the roles, including CTO. Tell me about Fuse.
Sure. So Fuse is a defense tech company. We do mostly airborne communication and data dissemination in the tactical environment. Fuse was founded about 12 years ago by Sunder Lee, who was a naval aviator. So he was in the Navy flying helicopters. He was doing this design thinking stuff and which really brings out the user and has a big focus on the user and process associated with the user. And so he started Fuse. And then I joined a couple of years later after we got a big contract, and I was employee number 5. And then I started bringing engineering rigor and building up the team and building all the processes associated with engineering. We do a lot of experiments where we'll fly planes around and show our capabilities and our products. So we make a product called the Core, which has an embedded encryptor in it. Well, it's got red side processing and black side processing. And so right away, we hit the point that I wanted to talk about with the architecture. So if you're familiar with the Alice, Bob, Eve picture.
I am, but why don't we just define some terms for those listening? So the red side, black side, Alice, Bob, Eve. Is that what you were about to do?
That's what I was about to do.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Let me give it a shot here. Okay.
Do it without the whiteboard.
Yeah, I will. Yes. So you typically have Alice and Bob, and Alice wants to communicate with Bob securely. Then there's a person named Eve in the middle, Evil Eve, that wants to hear this message. So Alice can send a message, and they'll use encryption to do that. So there'll be an encryptor with Alice, and then there'll be an encryptor with Bob, and then there'll be some channel in the middle. Alice, for example, will say, Putin is in the bathroom. And then if it's maybe the reverse encryptor, it'll change it to like, bathroom is in Putin. And so Eve will see this message, bathroom is in Putin, that doesn't make any sense because it's encrypted. And then it'll go to the decryptor side. And then the decryptor will change that back from the bathroom is in Putin to Putin's in the bathroom. And then Bob will get the real message that Putin's in the bathroom, and then Bob can send a nuclear bomb or whatever, you know, whatever needs to happen. But that's really the setup. So the red side where Alice and Bob live is also called the plain text side because that's the real message. And that's red and it's scary, right? Because it's got the real information that's secure. Like when you have your password, you write your password down or you don't write your password down, it's in your head. And so you're worried about people getting your password. So the red is scary, so it's red. And then the black is not scary. So when it's in that encrypted state where Eve is, that's the black side. So we also call it plain text for the high side by Alice and Bob and ciphertext by the low side, which is the black side by Eve.
Very cool.
And so sometimes when I've described this situation to the company, I'll use the Ovaltine encoder too. So I just use this weird reverse encoder. But if you've seen Christmas Story, everybody's seen Christmas Story, right?
I mean, you're talking to a South African who may not be... Is it one where there's a dude in a red suit that drops gifts off for kids and then leaves?
Yeah, it's all these standard Christmas things in there where the guy sticks his tongue on a metal pole. They get a Christmas tree and they have a weird gift. You haven't seen this movie? They play it back to back.
I haven't, but I do love Dumb Dumber, where I've seen Jeff Daniels stick his tongue against a frozen pole.
Probably a similar sort of thing.
Okay, so back to Ovaltine.
Yes. Oh, you're going to miss the encoder. So in the movie, the guy gets an Ovaltine encoder in his box of Ovaltine, and over the radio, they send him a message, and they give him all these numbers. He figures out what the message is, because he uses his Ovaltine encoder that comes in his box of Ovaltine. And he's all depressed because it says, eat more Ovaltine or something. But if you haven't seen the movie, then the reference isn't going to do you a lot of good. But the movie is hilarious.
Yeah, I'm sure many people listening have seen the movie. So don't worry about me.
Okay. Next, when Christmas comes around next time, you have to see this movie. Because it's got a lot of Americana. American culture is just...
all over it.
But anyway, so there's the setup. So we're talking about the red side, which is where Alice and Bob live, and then Eve on the black side. And so our box, we call it multifunction network controller. So it's a compute environment, and it's got this embedded encryptor. So you got to do some processing usually on the red side and on the black side. So our box, and we have a patent on removable computers in this little multifunction network controller. And so this allows us to use commercial technology on the black side, and it allows us to use military technology on the red side. So then we can have a mix of red radios and black radios, and they're all combined into one compute, and it's airborne qualified, so we can fly it in aircraft. And then we've written software into this compute so that it manages all the different radios and the network routers. So it's it really manages the radios and the routers and everything, and it provides visualization too. And so we have this huge database full of all these networking parameters. They're not networking in the OSI like layer 3 sense, but networking in the holistic cross-layer sense. So we have a view of the radio, what the RF is doing, what the network's doing, what the applications are doing. So we have a view of the whole cross-layer communication problem. And so what's neat about that is there's some called electromagnetic interference and electromagnetic compatibility. That's usually if the device functions correctly. So it's got to withstand a bunch of EMI to be electromagnetically compatible. So for us, we're Tempus certified. So you don't want Eve to hear any of the electromagnetic red side information. So we had to jump through a bunch of hoops to make sure that our compute, our core, is Tempus certified. So you can't hear any RF on the black side from the red side. You don't want it to leak out, right?
So you can't even see the traffic from the black side.
Correct. And you can't see the RF associated with it. There's all these stories of like Russian ships in the 80s out in front of a Spey War listening to people type on keyboards. And then they could, all this EMI sort of problem. So
now, are you sort of in a cat and mouse game where you are Tempus certified, your core can hide the RF on the red side, but then Eve just figures out, oh, this is how they do it. And then Eve can once again hear you on the red side. And then you've got to scramble to change the technology. And it's this sort of back and forth cat and mouse game. Or how does that work?
It is. It's a problem. And that encryptor that we have is called a HAPI encryptor. So it's also certified by the NSA. There's like a red side Ethernet and a black side Ethernet. And those need to be a certain distance apart from each other. And that changes every once in a while, like you're saying. And then there's, when you put the key into the encryptor, it's a special thing. There's a DS-101 interface, so you have to have this special piece of equipment called an SKL, which holds keys. And you go to like a Navy base, and then you have them load some keys into the SKL. And then you go to the encryptor, and you squirt the key into the core box. So that the key will only live for a certain amount of time. So there's all these sort of things that you need to worry about.
I don't want to get too deep into this for technical ignorance, but I read up on how Bluetooth encryption works. So let's say I have my headphones on and I'm listening to my songs on my iPhone. Just that little Bluetooth communication and then how quickly it changes keys and how you're constantly trying to hide the ability from Eve to decode what you're doing, on that signal. It's like a rapid changing of the encryption keys and all that, and broken up into slices. And there's a fascinating game.
Yeah, it is. I've done a lot of Bluetooth stuff, but it was always prototype. So we just turned it off and we just kind of tried to make it work and show what's going on.
But I'm imagining in the core product, there's constant ways in which you need to know how to keep your information encrypted or hidden from Eve.
Yep. But when you use that HAPI certified compute, it allows you to use commercial technology. So when it's black, it's black. So then we want to get information about those black side radios on the red side so you can see the holistic picture of both the red radios and the black radios. And so we've developed a technology called UNEM that uses a special filter that kind of lets you go around the crypto just for the meta information associated with the radios.
Can you speak to this red side, black side in terms of, you said once you're on the black side, you can go commercial because it's just standard, I suppose. Can you give an example? Is it so that you can have a bunch of red and black communication in the same network? So for instance, one line is unsecured and one line is secured and no one needs to know or care? Or what is the use case for that?
Some of the best SATCOM connections are commercial. A military radio would have encryption in the radio, say a handheld soldier. So a soldier has a handheld radio that's got encryption in it. So then you can go use that encryption over like a first hop to maybe a plane or something. And then you could use the plane could use commercial SATCOM, maybe GEO or whatever, to go to a classified spot.
Got it. And then, so for instance, what you're saying is you could have an encrypted communication transported over commercial black side without the fear of that stuff being decrypted or seen along the way, maybe seen. And then when on the decryption side, that will once again be a device with your hardware in it to do the decryption.
Not necessarily our hardware too, because the government has
standard protocols. Okay.
A standard, yeah. So, but there's rules too. So when you spin up a secret data, you need to worry about what the paths are as well. So it can't be just any old path, but it can be more lenient.
If you look at the recent drone attack from Iran on Israel and that dome, you know, how they have the Iron Dome, but then all sorts of other systems as well that shoot those missiles down, you think to yourself, the location and the tracking accuracy and the speed and the response is incredible, but it all goes away if you can somehow neutralize the signal between the ground and the air. Same goes for drones, right? I mean, people talk about the drone warfare, but there's the signal between the station and the drone. And instead of attacking the drone, you could attack the signals somehow. I don't know, through EMP or something.
Jamming. So there's a bunch of jamming technology. Yeah, so people are trying to jam.
Yeah. So that's the world you're in.
Yeah.
Do you know when your systems are compromised? Can one know?
Yeah, so we monitor that sort of thing, and so we can see if there's jamming going on. What's unique is that we have this data store that has all of the cross-layer information, right? So a lot of times you'll hear people they'll only work at layer 3, you know, they'll have networking, or they'll do firewalls and do layer 7. Our approach gets layer 1 information, layer, you know, the whole holistic thing. So it's really neat that we have that data store. That's kind of exciting.
Just for those listening, the OSI layers 1 through 7, I think 1 is hardware.
Yeah, physical.
Can you just list those off for those who don't know what that is?
So it's called physical, data link, network, transport layer, session layer. They get murky. A lot of people, the layers 5, 6, and 7, 7 is the application layer. The OSI guys in the 80s, they made like kind of too many layers or something, but yeah. It was funny because they had another protocol. So they had a whole nother competing to TCP/IP, but it cost a lot of money to get this standard. And so this OSI protocol kind of died, and the free TCP/IP made up in Berkeley or whatever, that one took over the world. So it's kind of funny that I guess they priced themselves out or something. So what we often do is we put these things in pods too and fly them under a wing. So if we have a legacy airplane that has weapons connectors, it's called a MIL Standard 1670, but we can attach a pod with a bunch of different radios and then give communication capabilities to legacy aircraft. That's pretty cool. And then we've developed this protocol called 7221. That lets you use old cables in planes and lets you run IP. So you used to use an old protocol called 1553. And so just like DSL, so the 1553 goes up to 15 megahertz. And just like DSL in the 90s, where they would use the top half and run IP over old phone lines, we play the same game with this 7221 stuff. So we're able to run IP data across old 1553 cables in planes. And so it takes an act of God to string new cables in these planes, right? But by using 7221, you can just screw in a couple things and then boom, you're running IP over these old cables. So that's proven pretty useful for us too.
Wow. Now, just a random question on that. You know when the Blue Angels fly and they fly like right next to each other and the wings almost touch?
Yeah.
Are they doing that by hand, or they're doing that, is it coordinated through communication between the planes?
I don't know. I was in Pensacola for a day once, but that's all I know. I'm not a Blue Eagles. Yeah. Sorry, Ian.
you're like explaining cutting edge technology to me, and I'm like, do the Blue Angels fly manually, or do they
The Blue Angels. Yeah, I don't even know.
Well, I just can't believe it. You can fly so fast and just be so close to each other and not have the aid of technology.
Yeah, it's amazing. I was in Chicago and they buzzed us one time. We were in this park. It was pretty low. Pretty amazing how those guys fly so close to each other.
So does your technology expand to satellites?
Yeah, so we'll fly Starlink terminals around sometimes and have them cross band with other links. Like I was talking about, you'll use like a military handheld link and then we'll shove data over there or sensor data. So that's been useful for us. And then we also do, so the new thing really is called multi-constellation. So you're worried that the enemy is going to blow up a certain constellation. So if they did it correctly, they could blow up all the GEO satellites or all the PLEO satellites or maybe all the, you know, or get cyber, you know, use a cyber technique to crash them. So what we do is we want to have communication capable to all the different constellations. So yeah, so the PLEO, as you move away from the Earth, you need to go slower and slower because there's less gravitational force. So with the Starlink, you're really low. The space shuttle has like an 80-minute orbit. There's a really low satellite. So the space shuttle is just spinning around 80 minutes. It goes around the Earth. So I built these LEO satellites. They weren't PLEO. They were more like regular LEO. There were six on orbit, and it was called the Orbcomm constellation.
What's the difference between PLEO and LEO?
So PLEO is proliferated. So that means that there's just billions of them. I think there's like 30,000 satellites right now, or 40, 30, something like that. And a huge portion of those are Starlink. Before they started, SpaceX started putting up all these satellites, there's just, it's like a quarter of them or something. It's amazing how many of those. So the constellation I dealt with that I created in the, we replenished it. So the first time the Orbcomm constellation was in 1995. And so they did low Earth orbits, but really low bandwidth stuff for like Caterpillar trucks, so you could get information about your assets and things like that. So those things had 32 satellites.
And when you say constellation also, do they communicate with, just like I was hoping the Blue Angels airplanes communicate with each other, do the satellites communicate to sort of stay in position, or does that all come from ground station?
Yeah, so that's called cross-linking. What's really cool is that when you're in the satellite world, your link between the assets is really clean. So you can get away with free space optics. You can run lasers. So all of those, like the Starlink satellites, they couldn't do it maybe 8 months ago. I think it was something like that. They were having some problems on the first iteration of the Starlink satellites, but then they got it nailed down. And so all those Starlink satellites are able to communicate with each other via laser. The movement is so deterministic. You know, there's no air bouncing you around. There's no clouds. So people do free space optics stuff. They'll even in like fix from like the top of one building to another building. If you have like a campus, then they'll run free space optics. But it doesn't work that great because it's really, you have to point it really hard. You have tight tolerances for pointing. And then also when a cloud comes along, really bad things happen. But up in space, there's no clouds, and the movement of the satellites is so deterministic that you can get away with really pointing lasers at each other. So there's all these crosslinks now. It didn't work, I think, about 8 months, maybe. It was more, maybe a year and a little bit. But in the beginning, they were having a lot of problems with it, and then boom, it works great now. So
clouds can be catastrophic because I went to Texas to go see the eclipse.
Wow, okay.
And we couldn't see it because the clouds were in the way. At least it went dark, but clouds were in the way.
Yeah. So it was totality?
It was totality. So it went really dark. We were in a great geolocation, but we situationally, you know, I mean, I think I underestimated how tropical the weather is sort of in South Texas, you know, the Gulf. I don't know. I never really associated the Gulf with Texas, even though it's on the Gulf.
like Galveston or something, or South Padre Island or something like that?
Yes. So we went to South Padre Island and, of course, went to Boca Chica to see the Starbase. What a phenomenal experience. Just driving up to the launch pad where, you know, Starship is launched from. And like, I was just shocked at the access we had.
Oh, how close do you get to launch?
Yeah. Have you been there?
I have not been there, but I moved on from that company after we had a prototype satellite launch, this Orbcomm satellite I'm talking about. And then about maybe a year, they launched about 8 of them. And that was the first time they were able to land on a floating thing. So
the drone ship.
Yeah. So they were able to, the first booster, they were able to land it on the thing. They launched, I think there was 8 Orbcomm satellites for that one.
And that was your work?
Yeah, that was in 2012.
Why does Orbcomm sound so familiar?
I don't know. They do this low bitrate. They have this constellation. They started in 1995, which is pretty crazy. They were launching rockets from planes. And yeah, that was a wild ride because we got that contract at San Diego Research Center because one of the founders had worked on it. And then we got bought by Argonne ST that does a bunch of signal stuff, and then we got bought by Boeing. So at the end, we were Boeing, but then we built all those. We built 19 of those satellites, the payload part.
Wow. Are you ready to elevate your team's performance and your own career as CTO? Introducing the 7CTOs Growth Program. With 7CTOs, you'll join a supportive community of tech leaders dedicated to helping you reach new heights. Our group coaching program, led by experienced CTOs, focuses on the proven CTO levels framework. Assess your team, processes, and technology challenges with our easy-to-complete assessments, and then dive deep into monthly coaching calls where you'll get unstuck and gain insights on specific topics. Craft actionable plans tailored to your needs, guided by expert advice and playbooks designed to drive results. Plus, gain access to our exclusive CTO community for ongoing support and collaboration. Sign up now and start your group coaching adventure for only $300 per month or $3,000 per year. Your membership includes priority access to all 7CTO's events and activities. Don't miss out on the opportunity to join a global community of experienced CTOs, attend virtual events, and participate in confidential group coaching sessions. Visit 7ctos.com/growth and level up your leadership skills today. So what is it like to CTO a very, very intense hybrid environment, probably with clearance? How did you divide up your teams, or just give me an insight into how you set things up to build your technologies?
You know, there's a lot of the standard configuration management processes and trying to keep the North Star going and trying to like keep the architecture flowing and trying to continue that. So we've just, you know, there's a lot of ideas coming in from the CEO, and then I'm trying to insert new technologies as well as getting a customer input. So we have a lot of processes for trying to get customer input. So we'll go to bases and interview pilots and interview ground support people. And so we'll interview a lot of warfighters, and then we've got like a process for trying to insert their, you know, their desires in our products so we can make better products. We do a lot of events too. So we've been to Pax River on the East Coast and Palmdale. So we'll go and we'll demonstrate the utility of our systems and how well our RF works. So a lot of it's trying to make checklists and just that whole process, test readiness reviews. So all that process that the government puts in place, I mean, when you work in this highly regulated environment with test readiness reviews and critical design reviews and preliminary design reviews and all that. So it's kind of tricky integrating that and trying to make them meaningful, you know. So a lot of times there's a lot of kind of red tape or bureaucracy in these processes, but really they make a lot of sense. And if you use them to really improve your product and improve the performance of the team, then that's good.
just give us some insight into the teams. Do you have a hybrid team? Do you have a hardware team? You have an embedded team? You have a software team? Or are they more integrated? Or
so we have four teams. There are five teams. So there's the cyber. We have a whole cyber team. We have a networking team. We have a system team, which includes mechanical engineering and electrical engineering. And then we have a software team. But really, the software team is kind of divided between an embedded team and then a front-end team. So there's like a web technologies team, and then there's like a bunch of C++ kind of embedded stuff. And so, the trick is integrating all of these. So it's challenging integrating all of the team's outputs, So the mechanical engineers, they'll put something, or maybe the electrical engineer might have put a wire the wrong way or something, and the software guys are like, my bits are working, and everybody's running out to the... So we have the system integration lab in the back. And so really it's like levels of fidelity, right? And so a big integration part is using, we'll do wired RF. So when you do wired RF and you have a bunch of different platforms, then you can use things like attenuators. So it's as if the platforms are, hundreds of miles apart, but you can just use the wire to emulate the channel between them. So you flush out a lot using those kind of things.
Do you also build emulators so that your software team could potentially work independently from, let's say, the next hardware revision?
We do. We have this thing called the virtual network testbed. And so our virtual network testbed allows us to have lots of different projects. So all of these projects support different network configuration scenarios, really. So we're doing a project for the government where we're making a user interface. And so this user interface is for a particular novel network that they've developed. And so we've had to emulate their novel network, and then we develop our user interface against that. So that VNTB has proven just really useful. So the first, maybe 6 years ago or something, we would go out to the field and try and set stuff up, and had some problems. And then we started just really employing the VNTB, and that's really proven really useful. And we make a product called a TANS, Tactile Airborne Network Simulator. And the TANS allows you to emulate RF channels. So you can fly planes around mountains and watch the signals go out and see how the applications behave when the signals go out and make sure the routing protocols, restore dynamically.
Yeah. In my mind, it's not virtual, right? You still want to have the RF signals.
So that's the wired RF that I'm talking about. But a lot of times we'll do virtual before we have the RF signals. But what we've done is we've created these things. We call them ARNIs, Abstract Radio Network Interface Emulators. So the ARNI will pretend to be a radio. So our software, typically we have this thing called the MANIAC, the Master Airborne Network Integrated Advanced Controller. And then that will talk to all the different radios. So we built out interfaces to all these different radios, software interfaces. So if a particular radio might be like an SNMP radio and it's got some peculiarities of that radio, then the AP knows how to talk to that radio, but then it can talk kind of in a uniform language to MANIAC. And so we built out all these access points, which are like radio drivers, really. And then we built virtual radios in TANs, and then our APs can talk to the virtual radios, and then we can flush our software out, and we can, what we can do too is it will take an event and we'll fly planes around, and then we'll have the data from how the plane flew in the actual event that we did, and then we can play it back in TANs and then see how our software behaved, and then we can, fix bugs and improve things, and that's proved really useful as well.
That's fascinating. And is that a box that when they fly around, they have to fly around with a box you put in there? Or do you download data from general data from the plane? Or
so to get the fidelity, it's the box that we had, because we really need sixed off. So you need a latitude, longitude, altitude, roll, pitch, and yaw. So you really want to know. So a lot of times we'll have antennas and they'll get blocked by a wing or something like that. And so we have different algorithms to deal with airborne dynamics and things like that. So we want to emulate all of that. So to get that, you really need, they call it the LARPy. So you want to get all of that data. And so there's this thing called Chapter 10 that is a format for like doing flight data recording like that. And we wanted to do that, but we never did it.
Do you think that when Blue Angel aeroplanes fly, that like do they use that data to synchronize their flying?
I would be surprised. I don't know what the crosslink is. It could be Link 16. I don't know if they do. I don't know. Sorry.
So maybe someone listening can send us this information.
Those Blue Angels are cool, though.
I just can't believe how close they are. I think I saw with the eclipse, there was a YouTube video of them three or four fighter jets flying underneath the eclipse, and they were so close to each other. It was ridiculous. I mean, I'm a little overwhelmed by everything you're saying. How do you just get shit done in this type of environment? There's so many moving parts.
There is a lot, yeah. So I just, you know, there's a lot of meetings, and then I keep my ears up to hear things I can sniff out. If I hear something that sounds like somebody might be going down the wrong path or something, then I'll have to jump in there. But I'm trying to stay, you know, high level and try and make processes and nail down the high level, really impactful stuff, right, that can be cross company. So it's challenging. But really the deal is, you know, it's all about that agile stuff, right? Across all the disciplines, it goes to the mechanical engineering. We need to build prototype units and see how they behave. And the software you need to build, well, software guys kind of know it, but still, software, you know, you need to get the demonstrations out, build prototype, build a little, test a little. So it's build a little, test a little across all the disciplines, really.
Do you have a VP or a director that's sort of your right-hand person to help with all those processes? Or do you just have a division lead for each department? Or
yes. Yeah, so we have a director of engineering, Alan McPhee. He's managing the engineering department.
Do I know him? I know him from when we met up years ago, right?
I think it might be before. Oh, no, you're right. He was there. Yep, exactly. And then we have Dennis Wozek. He's the program manager. So we have program managers.
I think what is tough for me is clearly you've had a long academic history. You're clearly very smart and you've been very experienced in this field. How do you empower your teams to not always be asking, well, what does Dell think? Or we should run this by Dell, or is Dell okay with this? Are your teams generally smarter than you are or more experienced than you are and you can kind of just let them go? Or do you feel like you kind of have to know what's going on because you're ultimately the supreme being in how all of this gets done? I ask only because there's a lot of CTOs in this situation where they are sort of the domain experts, and potentially teams get debilitated because they feel, well, we should first ask the CTO before we all move on with this next thing.
Yeah, it's been challenging. It just goes both ways, really. So sometimes I don't get exposed to different things, and then sometimes things are slow because they need me in the loop. But there's so many processes, and the team's really good. There was this architectural change, that software architectural change that is coming out, that was really, I had thought it should have been this way, you know, a long time ago, but over the time the whole system evolved. And I'm not as close to it as I was when it came out originally. And so I think, I really believe that the team has a better idea than the way I had envisioned it. So that's kind of an interesting.
You start off as the expert, the learning gets transferred, the team starts building stronger models of the ideas, and then you learn from that.
Yeah, I'd say that's accurate. That. You know, the coolest thing I ever thought, so we put these processes in place, and one of the engineering managers, he came to me and I'd said, I can't remember what I said, but I said something should be a certain way or something. And he came and he had the process, he cited the process, and he said, no, Dell, it's supposed to be this way, you know? And I'm like, oh, you're totally right. Yeah, yeah, that's great. And so if we can use the processes and get forward that way, then that's really where we need to go. I think that's really powerful.
I love that. Do you have challenges around AI or ML, or is there stuff that you're doing that you can share with us just briefly in terms of skating to where the puck is going in this industry?
So like I was talking about, we have this huge data store that has all of this information cross-layer across all these different things dynamically while we're doing an event for each platform. We're trying to put machine learning on top of that to optimize the network in the holistic sense of network. We wrote a paper, let's see, what was it, 2019, 20 maybe. It was a cognitive machine learning agent in networking, right, in airborne networking, cognitive machine learning agent in airborne networking. We just took a couple of those points that I'm describing, and then we fed them into like a Q-learning machine learning algorithm. And then we did it in TANS. So that tactical airborne network simulator that I'm talking about, we were able to take that and then fly a plane around in TANS so that the planes, oftentimes, they'll have a job to do. Like they're doing ISR surveillance, you know, and so they'll have some orbit, right? And so as things change, we can fly them in this orbit inside of TANS. And then what we did is we used a Q-learning algorithm, which does random things and then has a reward function. And then the reward function can optimize the knobs that it has. So we were like picking antennas, and then we were looking at the signal strength of the ground platform. And then we were trying to optimize all the amount of packets flowing between the ground and the plane. That was that paper. But we're trying to expand on that concept to really control all of the knobs that we have. It's a high dimensional problem because we've got like 50 parameters per radio, you know, and so there's lots of local minima, and so it's kind of a hard problem to do. But we were able to show how we could use the meters and knobs that we had to do a Q-learning algorithm. And then we're putting a GPU in the core, so we should be able to run a recommender system and do an NVIDIA GPU that's going to go in there. We've been doing that. We're working with a bunch of other companies. We're working with DeepSig, which is this company that does machine learning with RF, so they can do detection. And then we're working with Turbine One, which has computer vision, so it can do target tracking. We've done this autonomous boat, so we've been involved in a couple experiments with the SEALs recently, where we had autonomous boats driving around and they have cameras, and then we want to do autonomous detection of boats, and so that's been really good. And then we're working with this company, SensePoint AI, that does tasking, so they can decide where the boats might need to go to see what's going on. Those guys are cool because they use ontology and machine learning. So, I mean, when you talk about AI, it's this huge gamut, right? Zeroes on the machine learning a lot of times, but all the MBSE that we use. So we have these models of our environment. So we have different models for all the different radios in our model-based system engineering approach. So then we can figure out which radios are going to be best for the mission and figure out, you know, just play these kind of games and see where radios fit and this sort of thing. So that's all artificial intelligence too. But anyway, these SensePoint AI guys, they use ontologies, which semantically describe the world, in addition to machine learning, so they can do optimized tasking. So it's been fun working with those guys.
Wow, man. Well, Dell, I think my head looks like your whiteboard. Thanks for joining me and sharing some of your world with me.
Glad to do it. That was fun.
Talk to you soon. That's the show. Check out ctopod.com. Stay connected. We love hearing from CTOs. We love hearing from CEOs. Anybody who needs to get their CTO plugged in, check out 7ctos.com. There are membership levels for everybody, so it's never too late to expand your network, nurture your relationships, and please, let's see each other soon, like next week. Cheers.